Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 131, I am joined by Dr. M. Ali Khan of the Doheny Eye Institute, part of UCLA in Los Angeles, California. This is a journal club where we discuss four recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. The first two publications concern loss to follow-up in patients with age-related macular degeneration receiving intravitreal injections, and patients with proliferative diabetic retinopathy receiving intravitreal injection or panretinal laser. The following two papers are both an editorial concerning Phase 3 trials design subgroup analyses of Phase 2 trials, and ending with a discussion of a cross-sectional study of current ophthalmology chairs in the United States. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by one of our previous correspondents, Dr. M. Ali Khan. Dr. Khan is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the Doheny Eye Institute, part of UCLA in Los Angeles, California. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Shade. Good to be back.
We have so many things to catch up on. Fatherhood, private equity, NBA offseason, NFL season, USC football. But we have work to do, too. So we're going to start by talking about, this is a journal club. We're going to hit four articles recently published in major journals. And the first article we're going to talk about is actually from our alma mater. This is published by Anthony Obaid, who's a research fellow there et al. This was published August 23rd, 2018 online, called Loss to Follow-Up Among Patients with Neovascular Age-Related Macular Degeneration Who Received Intravitreal Antivascular Endothelial Growth Factor Injections. I'll just summarize what they saw. They essentially looked back at a huge cohort of patients to get a sense of which patients, how many patients, and that don't follow up, and what sort of factors are associated with patients not following up. So they looked back and they found 9,000 patients over a period of about 4 years, a little less than 4 years. And the rate of loss to follow-up was more than 20% when you say that at least a year is between visits. And the factors they found associated included older age, African-American or Asian patients, or patients of unreported race, lower gross income, patients who lived farther from a clinic, and patients with only eye disease in one eye. We can talk a little bit about the implications of this. Ali, just your first impressions, reading the study, seeing the results, and how you kind of interpret this for the context of your practice.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think it was a great study, something that's not published on enough. And I will give a shout out to Anthony Obaid, who, as you mentioned, is a research fellow who's applying to residency right now. And clearly, based on this journal club alone, probably deserves a residency spot at a very good program. But they looked at the number of patients. You know, we always look at treatment outcomes and phase three data and improvement in visual and functional and anatomic outcomes. But we don't really focus so much on the patients who just never show up again. So like you said, they looked at patients who were lost to follow for at least a year who were treated with anti-VEGF for neovascular AMD, and then looked, you know, multivariate and univariate analysis on what factors are risk factors for being lost to follow for a year after an injection for AMD. And some of the things I think mirrored my clinical practice. You know, the older the patient, the longer they or further away they live from the clinic, and the lower the adjusted gross income are risk factors for not coming back. I think, you know, older patients with more comorbidities, difficult travel, that kind of goes along with the distance to the clinic, you know, all makes sense. I think most of the patients who I feel like I kind of don't see as regularly as I hoped to see tend to be my older patients. And these in this study was, you know, 80 years and older. So definitely an older cohort. But some of the risk factors were definitely troubling. I think we might have suspected this, but it's hard to see kind of the real data that this may be true, that African-Americans, Asians, and patients who just don't list their race are more likely to be lost to follow-up as well. So I think we, as a retina community, ophthalmology community, kind of have some work to do. Again, this is one practice in one urban setting that may not, you know, apply to others in terms of the race factor, but certainly worth looking into.
Yeah, you know, and we're going to follow this up by discussing a very similarly designed study for proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And we're going to talk a little bit about the differences between the disease conditions, maybe our perceptions as physicians of our patient population. I mean, I'll start by, you know, just following, you mentioned limitations, you know, just to be complete, you know, they did define loss to follow-up as 12 months. And they had patients who had multiple intervals maybe included, though that was a very small percentage. That was about 1% of the patients included. They did use billing codes. This was a single practice. And they may be missing data because they're relying on Snell and Vision. This is not a randomized controlled study with ETDRS Vision, for example. But I will say this. I was surprised by the percentage. I think our perception of AMD when we talk about it, when we learned about it, when we talk to our fellows about it, is that AMD patients tend to be more compliant because they get a little more bang for their buck from injections in terms of if they have wet AMD with fluid and they get injections, they tend to notice an improvement. And that usually encourages patients to follow up. We'll talk about proliferative diabetic retinopathy in a second and the differences there. But like you said, older patients who may have socioeconomic or health issues that prevent them from following up. And we've mentioned this before in a different context, but communication maybe. You know, the differences in ethnic groups can't be overstated. And part of that may just be cultural barriers or just understanding barriers, even if someone speaks the same language. If we're not communicating effectively to certain racial or ethnic groups, maybe that results in less understanding of the disease process and lower follow-up rates.
Yeah, definitely. I think if there's you know, obviously a busy clinic and you have a caregiver or someone there who's translating for you, you never know. You know, I never feel like the patient really gets it as well as when I speak to them about it. So I think that sort of understanding the disease condition is big. I think what you mentioned about the vision is also important. I think they even discussed this in the article that people who were improving their visual acuity were less susceptible to being lost to follow up. And patients who were actually getting injections in both eyes rather than one eye were less likely to be lost to follow up as well. So patients who were perceiving they were getting better or who clearly had a problem in both eyes, so probably feared, significant vision loss if they didn't come back, were more likely to come back. So I think that matches kind of what you were discussing as well.
So this kind of feeds into other ideas. You know, we've talked before about drugs that would last longer, some of the benefits. I mean, one obvious benefit is these patients, maybe the loss to follow-up is not as critical for their vision. For example, if you have a drug or an injection that you know will last 12 or 18 months, similar to like the latter study kind of results, then maybe this loss to follow-up is not as critical or as damaging potentially to their vision. But like you referenced at the very beginning, real-world studies, we aren't ever looking at the patients who disappeared. And not real-world, I'm talking about the clinical trial data. We're not looking at patients who disappeared. We're looking at the patients who stayed enrolled in the trial. So, but we do can kind of mix this with that data, which showed that if patients don't receive treatment in a timely fashion, that they do leave vision on the table. We're going to feed in, you know, Anthony Obaid, unintentionally, it is the star of this journal club, and partly because these are both fascinating articles, both published in AAO. So the next one is called Outcomes of Eyes Lost to Follow with Proliferative Diabetic Retinopathy that Received Panretinal Photocoagulation versus Intravitreal Anti-VEGF. This was presented at ARVO back in April in Hawaii. This was presented in Vancouver for ASRS, Retina Society just this past weekend. It will present it again at Academy in Chicago. And this was published in Ophthalmology in the last month. And Ollie, you just want to tell us a little bit about this study and kind of the results and what can we take from this?
Yeah, so again, this is another great article by Anthony Obaid. So this was another loss to follow-up study, but instead this the study actually compared loss to follow-up outcomes, you know, functional and visual, in patients who received treatment for PDR either with anti-VEGF injection or PDR exclusively. So looked at those two treatment modalities. Then patients who were lost to follow-up for 6 months, at least 6 months, were then looked at in terms of their final visual acuity, final anatomical outcomes. So again, this is a shorter loss to follow-up interval than, say, the prior study in neovascular AMD. This is also different in that it compared to treatment modalities and also looked at, you know, final visual and anatomical outcomes, which I think is why this report is getting quite a bit of interest, both at the meeting scene and elsewhere. So they found that the patients who were treated with PDR and PRP had actually lower rates of traction retinal detachments and neovascular complications at final visit, and also did not have a significant difference in final visual acuity compared to the visit just before they were lost to follow-up. That differed from the patients who were treated with anti-VEGF, who did have worse visual acuity at final follow-up and were more likely to have traction retinal detachments and neovascularization of the iris. So the authors concluded that patients treated with anti-VEGF had worse anatomic and functional outcomes compared to eyes receiving PRP, which is obviously, in light of Protocol S and kind of this push to use anti-VEGF for PRP, as an alarming sign.
Yeah, I think that this is great. The bridge between clinical trial data and real world data. Of course, limitations is always very useful when discussing any paper, and retrospective study, there's differences in the DME prevalence between these arms because that probably influenced whether or not they got anti-VEGF or laser up front.
Right.
And, sample size is not huge. So they mentioned that NVG, things like that, may be harder to evaluate. And then a lot of the patients didn't come back. And that's a limitation, but that also is that's a limitation of analyzing why the vision or what the vision is finally in these patients. But that's actually still more to the point that if a lot of these patients aren't following up, there's a couple things true. One, we need to do a better job of communicating to these patients the importance of coming back, maybe. And again, there may be cultural, racial, socioeconomic barriers to that communication that we need to work on. But that may, again, argue that if you have a treatment like anti-VEGF that doesn't offer a permanent effect with just a single injection for a patient, that maybe that there is more bang for your buck with doing laser. And this is a hard thing to know. There's a lot of ethical and weird kind of questions about whether you can just make that can you make a prejudgment of a patient that they're not going to come back and determine your treatment? And that's a whole, can of worms I don't really want to open because there's different arguments both ways. But at the very least, if we know which patients are higher risk of not coming back, then we can at least change our counseling practices and maybe try to reach those patients better.
Right. Yeah, this study is different from the other article about neovascular AMD, where the focus was not necessarily on sort of risk factors for being lost to follow-up. This is more sort of what outcomes you get when they do come back. So I think kind of that can of worms you're discussing is, you can't prejudge someone based on these baseline characteristics and decide to treat them with, say, one or the other treatment arms. I think you should still do what you think is overall best for the patient. And again, the prevalence of, baseline DME and how that influenced the treatment is obviously important. I think, one thing I know that, this practice, Mid-Atlantic Retina, did is actually now has a little bit more stringent follow-up in terms of communication, sending certified letters and calling the patients that have been found to lost to follow-up. So, that wasn't necessarily as actively done in real time, but then now looking back at the study results, I think it is a good sort of wake-up call to say that maybe we do need to be more proactive in getting some of these patients back, not because of, us, treating them or, giving them more injections or PRP, but because clearly vision can turn to the worse. And in the patients who had a tractional retinal detachment, that's just a mess that you're not going to ever get fully back to their baseline, at least in my opinion. So I think both articles taken together are great in sort of bringing awareness to this issue of loss to follow-up and maybe, what we need to do better to change that.
Yeah, those are good points. And I think this idea, we've talked about, I think actually you may have been on this journal club there, and we've talked about using anti-VEGF, for example, even if you plan to do PRP to kind of quote unquote cool down the retinopathy if it's very active. We talked about an article, I believe from Britain, which was looking at outcomes if you inject, even if you plan to laser versus just lasering in terms of visual outcomes. There seemed to be some benefit in starting patients with injections, even if your plan is to do PRP. But I've found, at least in my practice, that there's a worrisome, again, you have to keep track. A lot of times you'll inject the patient and they won't come back for their laser, even if you had planned to do it. So what I've started doing, at least personally, is kind of independently looking at my schedule at the end of every clinic day seeing who didn't show up and then kind of flagging patients to call them. And I think a lot of practices are automating this practice. But I think especially for these PDR patients, it's super critical because I think, unfortunately, we've all seen, like you referenced, anecdotal examples where things can go down the tubes really fast. Are you doing similar things out on the West Coast in terms of tracking these patients?
Yeah, I think, UCLA, it's academic practice, so each physician kind of does their own thing a little bit in terms of what they want staff to do. But I certainly do flag patients who are treated with anti-VEGF or laser for whatever the condition is. And if they've exceeded their recommended return interval by, double the number of weeks, so essentially one missed visit, I ask for a phone call. If it's more than one visit, then a certified letter and a phone call. And then if it's, three visits in a row, then, a third phone call. So it's actually quite a bit of work for the staff for some of these people. But we've been able to recapture, my clinical volume isn't as huge as the practice that, published these two articles, but I've seen pretty good return on follow-up using that method. So it's definitely labor intensive, and it's almost, it's not something you're used to in medicine where the doctor is sort of ensuring that the patient comes back. We sort of put that onus on the patient to, return as recommended and say, hey, if you didn't come back, that's your problem. But I think these studies show that maybe, we do need to do a little bit better job as physicians to kind of help the patients help themselves. I don't know if it's really okay to say it's our responsibility to make sure they come back. Maybe some of these patients decided to not come back because, they didn't want any further treatment for this and were accepted their vision, et cetera. And people have the right to do that. But I think as long as we're honest with ourselves on how good our communication and sort of explaining the disease process, I don't think there's any harm in us sort of trying our best to make sure these people come back.
Yeah, that's really well stated. Well, these are both kind of two real-world retrospective studies. And our next paper we're going to talk about is not even a study. It's actually just an editorial. One of my colleagues, Dr. Phil Rosenfeld, along with William Fuhrer here from Bascom Palmer, they wrote this editorial entitled Lessons from Recent Phase 3 Trial Failures. Don't design Phase 3 trials based on retrospective subgroup analyses from Phase 2 trials. This was published in Ophthalmology in the last month. Ali, we don't have to rehash everything that was written here. People can go read the paper if they like, but can you just summarize quickly what Dr. Rosenfeld and Mr. Furrow were talking about and what you kind of take from this as someone who has to interpret clinical trial data?
Yeah, this is honestly, I thought a great editorial. I think that the title is very specific, and I think the last sentence of the article is very specific on sort of how they feel about designing phase three trials. But basically, it looked at, the past few years, kind of big, hopeful, potentially blockbuster drugs failed in terms of their phase three outcome measures. And Dr. Rosenfeld and Dr. Fuhrer sort of looked at the design of those phase three trials and noticed kind of some, maybe not necessarily an error, but sort of certain patterns in interpretation of the phase two data that maybe predispose them to failure in phase three, and specifically the use of subgroup analysis from phase two studies to sort of design your inclusion criteria and cohorts for phase three. And they strongly advised against that and kind of went through the three drugs that recently failed to sort of prove their point, looking specifically at the phase two data, how that was melded into the phase three and showed, there were adjustments to phase three inclusion criteria and how that, likely set them up for failure. So I think it's a point well taken. I think, subgroup analysis at all our specialty meetings and, ASRS, Retina Society, AAO are very common and popular because they're, there's data out there to mine and to present, but that's, again, a retrospective subgroup analysis that is not powered, is not meant to be used for sort of a primary outcome. So thus, we should not be using that to set up a phase three study, which I think is a point well taken. And using the case studies of three recent failures, I think, more than adequately proves their point.
Subgroup analyses, like you said, and secondary outcomes that weren't initially the primary outcome are very interesting, right? Because as they mentioned here, and you referenced, from a pure research perspective, like if you go all the way back to your basic biology class in high school or college, right? Any research study set up with a hypothesis, with a null kind of hypothesis, and then your primary outcome that you're looking at, And really, that's the simplicity of the scientific method, right? You're looking at one factor. You usually don't have multiple variables in a perfect study. You have controls and you have your variable, and it shouldn't be multiple. And then you just, you know, is this true? For example, does lampalism have work for patients with this, with geographic atrophy of this level, but patients of this vision for AMD? And like you said, you know, there aren't that many clinical trials. There are a lot, but we can't do a trial for every single subgroup sometimes. So we extrapolate data. We do subgroup analyses. We do we data mine. We pool results from different trials, or at least we pull results from different trials to emphasize a point. And this has been true even, for example, for FDA approval of drug. I mean, ranibizumab was already approved, but the indication of ranibizumab being for diabetic retinopathy, not just for diabetic macular edema, came from, you know, secondary analysis of RISE-RIDE that showed that the diabetic retinopathy severity score was improved in patients who got ranibizumab. And that resulted in an FDA addition to the indication. And they're not, it's not necessarily wrong, but from a pure scientific perspective, it can be a problem. Now, you can argue if that's actually practical, but here there is an argument here, and I think it's well stated. There are multiple examples, as you referenced, that not adhering to that scientific method can get you into trouble. And as I said, the right. Phase 3 trials are super expensive. They're labor intensive. It's from an individual level, it's disappointing for the individual patient, whether they were enrolled in the trial or whether they're anxiously awaiting whether the trial will show benefit. And now they can't get this drug that they were hoping, we're all hoping would come to market and change their disease process. And from a global level, it's a huge investment of time and resources and money that just essentially just disappears once the trial is done. Like all of these drugs kind of, when they fail phase 3, there's no real going back. So this is great. I mean, again, I don't think we talk about trial design enough. I think most of us aren't basic scientists. Most of us are practical physicians. We like to know real world data. We like to have things that we can practically use on a day-to-day level. But it is very important to always keep in mind what a subgroup analysis is, what is data mining, what is kind of secondary outcomes. Because if you're not, from pure scientific method, if you weren't looking for that outcome, there is a limitation to kind of taking that as a key takeaway from a study.
Right. Yeah. And they did mention that if you do a secondary analysis and you think there is something there, maybe it's best to go from a phase 2 to another phase 2 rather than jumping from a phase 2 to a phase 3. And maybe that, you know, every step is extra money, as they mentioned, but maybe less money on a second phase 2 rather than, you know, a large phase 3. I will say, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there's a intersection here between industry and research, right? So from an industry perspective, I think sometimes there's a rush or a race to sort of
pressure.
Be the first in class treatment for a drug. And this is a lot of potential money. And some of these companies already have a lot of money to sort of spend on these type of things. So one of the studies was the Mahalo study for GA, where there currently is no treatment. So, you know, maybe there is a little bit more laxity in sort of the design and sort of the adherence to kind of these firm research principles because there's really no treatment yet for that group, a group of patients. So I think, you know, kind of understanding where industries, you know, where their incentives are and some of the kind of the nature of the current treatments for these diseases also explains maybe why things were done less stringently maybe than past phase 3 designs. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in future trials on sort of diseases where we already have a clear treatment class, like anti-VEGF, and those that we don't, like geographic atrophy.
Right, and the industry part of it too. You know, a lot of these studies are funded. You know, thankfully, most of them from companies that have a good financial base, as you said. But you know, they depend on a board of directors, and they depend on investor confidence. And it's very time-consuming to do any one of these trials. It can be hard to demand patience from an investor group or a board of directors that, you know, essentially is like, okay, they just want to move forward with the project. But I think that the important thing, Dr. Rosenfeld, is he's not just appealing to the scientific part of this. He's showing that these examples that even from a business perspective, if you want this product to succeed, it's worth that extra investment. Because ultimately, it doesn't benefit anyone if the product doesn't succeed. So it's nice to kind of show that dual. It's not just, obviously, we love it for the pure scientific part of it and for how you, that making sure that data is quote-unquote pure, but it's also showing from a practical level, maybe better for companies or whoever's funding the study to kind of take a step back and be like, well, if we really want this to work, let's do it right.
Right.
Well, the last paper we're going to talk about, again, this is more of a descriptive study, is entitled Chairs of United States Academic Ophthalmology Departments, a Descriptive Analysis and Trends. This is from American Journal of Ophthalmology in August. I'll just quickly describe. I mean, this is pretty simple. They did a cross-sectional study using a web search to look at 111 U.S. ophthalmology chairs and just what was their demographic and academic data. So big points, mostly 90% men. Chairs tend to be right around 60 years old, but they were appointed around age 47. Most of them graduated from American medical schools. About a quarter had additional degrees, including a master's or a PhD. Most of these were split between cornea, retina, and glaucoma fellowships, and only 5% of chairs had not completed a fellowship. Massioneer, Wilmer, Bascom, Palmer had trained the most number of chairs, and 32% of chairs actually had a program they trained at, more commonly as a resident than as a fellow. Average number of publications per chair, over 100, and 27 programs changed chairs over a four-year period, which is pretty significant. That's about almost just under a quarter of chairs turned over. So, I mean, the take-homes, this is, again, a descriptive study. That, I mean, I stated most of the take-homes. Just your interpretation of this data, Ali, did anything surprise you in terms of the data? If it didn't surprise you, what sort of things did it kind of emphasize for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff wasn't necessarily surprising in that, you know, just like other fields of medicine, which they do discuss in their discussion, you know, most of the chairs are white males who are fellowship trained and who, you know, did medical school in the United States, with a good percentage of people having trained at the institution that they are a chair at, kind of mirrors what I think about when I think of chairs that, you know, I've met or programs that I've thought about, you know, nationally across the country as it stands now. I think some of the implications of, you know, how these statistics should and may change in the future is something that will be interesting to follow, such as, you know, as the percentage of female residents and fellows increases, you know, will that ever, will that trend, and there has been a trend in increased number of female chairs, but will that sort of proportion be matched, and similar to race, such as the percentage of African-American residents in ophthalmology have remained stagnant based on the study. So maybe that's a sign that, you know, we need to do something, because, you know, representation in big positions such as chairs is important. And, you know, Asian Americans comprise a large number of ophthalmology residents, but, you know, will there be an increase in the proportion of chairs of that racial group remains to be seen. So some of those things that we need to all think about, sort of representation and making sure that leadership positions are also given, you know, in a manner that reflects our diversity, both, you know, age, race, and gender, are we actually making that? Because if not, you know, what are the factors that are preventing this? Because based on the numbers alone, they should.
Right. And I'll just say this. The one thing that did surprise me was the average age at which people became chair. I would always think of it as an older age. 47 is not old, you know, from the context of if you finished fellowship, I guess, in your early 30s on average, 15 years, you know, out is when you become a chair. That's less than I would have thought off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think that it'd be interesting to see if they did the age of the chairman or chairwoman, you know, and stratify it by the, you know, perceived rank of the program, such as based on those USMLE or Doximity or other ranking systems, because kind of the programs I think of, you know, the quote unquote, the top programs do tend to be much older than that 47 years of age, but kind of the other programs where you don't know who the chair are, you know, I guess we aren't thinking of age and that sort of thing. So I guess there's hope for us still yet, Jay. We have about 10 to 15 years before we get to that age, but you know, I think that what a chair does is so different now than in the past that, you know, it's not just about your own research credentials and sort of your place at your institution or your career, but now sort of how good you can be at fundraising and how good are you at managing, you know, many different faculty members with finite resources. How are you going to deal with kind of a changing funding environment from, you know, private and public institutions and keeping your faculty there given those demands? So I think age maybe younger age people might be better at that because they've gone through it themselves or have experience going through that, while an older person who sort of came up at a time of their career where things were different may not be as good. So, I don't think, age thing maybe makes sense given the changing environment. And, I would be interested, they mentioned the number of chairs who had an MBA and, maybe these other kind of dual degrees that suggest expertise and backgrounds other than, just science will become more prevalent as things go on.
I'm going to state two things that are interesting from this paper personally to me. University of Miami, not only the record for the number of first round picks in the same draft for football, three chairs. Look, UM, go UM. That's great. I can't think of who those three chairs are. I know Dr. Cooperman went to UM, but it's bad. I should know as an alum who the other two were off the top of my head. The other thing is either the abstract said Mass Eye and Ear Wilmer Bascom is the most common for chairs, but abstracts can be misleading because both the Cullen Eye Institute associated with Baylor and Wills also had four, so it should have been a three-way tie for third. So Wills got the short end of the stick there along with Baylor. I just want to apologize to you, Ali, as a Wills resident alum.
I don't know if that was shade in this article or not, but I did notice that as well. But, it's funny because when I was a resident, Julie Haller still chair. So I always had this, picture of, a strong, woman, female chair, very accomplished in retina. And, to see that from this article, that's a minority. It's kind of surprising to see, where you train and what you think is normal mm-hmm. may not be nationally. So these kind of articles, I think, are a good way to kind of remind you of really where the trends are. And maybe you might think things are going okay in terms of, diversity, representation, that sort of thing, but they may not be on a national scale. So articles like this, even though they are descriptive, I think they're thought-provoking in a more broad sense, which I think is worthwhile.
The last piece of minutia from this article, the range of publications, 0 to 850. So there is somebody becoming a chair without ever publishing, which is really encouraging for all of us. But there is somebody who's published 850 times, which is depressing to think about and really, really amazing by whoever did that. So just kudos.
Do you notice also that H index? I don't know if that's being talked about a lot at UM, but at UCLA it certainly is. But the H index is a measure of not only the number of publications you have, but sort of the impact of those publications. So then it's technically the X number of times one of your article has been published X or been cited X number of times by another publication. So an H index of 24 means they have 24 articles that have been cited at least 24 times by other people. And that's becoming a more widespread use in academics to sort of assess somebody's productivity research wise. So the mean and median H index of current ophthalmology chairs was 24 and 22. And generally, at least at UCLA, I've been quoted that you need to have an H index of 15 to be sort of promoted from, say, an assistant professor to an associate professor range. And I think that next jump from 15 to 24 is sort of the measure for associate to full professor. So I think, that measure is going to become increasingly mentioned and important in our times, at least in terms of academics.
Well, we'll finish up there. Just a couple quick things we'll hit before I let you go. First thing, your fatherhood, Zane Khan, is growing up well. Yeah. You guys are good?
Yeah, five months strong. So he's getting cooler by the week. So it's been good so far.
He was born. He was a Khan. He was born cool. Don't try to. Pose. Second thing, private equity, we don't discuss rumors here, so we're not going to talk about groups that may be rumored to sell the private equity or may not. We've talked about that off air, but it's kind of out now, so we can mention, NJ Retina, one of the bigger groups in the country, New Jersey, has different branches throughout Jersey, and it's been confirmed this week they did sell the private equity. We've talked before, Dr. Vander, who's one of our mentors, talked about private equity a bit. We're not going to belabor the private equity issue, but give us the young retina specialist impression of this whole situation, at least so maybe we're not factual, but at least kind of what our impressions are as a generation.
It's not, it's a little unnerving. I don't think it makes any young person sort of our age or younger feel good. I guess, part of the reason why is I think people our year and the year or two above us have been the ones sort of been hit by this, meaning just before they were going to be full partner in their practice, there was a private equity sale. And, you know, as conventional knowledge goes, private equity is maybe not as good for an associate as it is for, you know, a full partner. So the more and more this happens, whether it's consolidation from private equity or practices themselves are choosing to consolidate, I think it gives a young person a little bit of pause in terms of how the field is going and if this is going to affect, I think the general impression that this is going to affect us all in a negative fashion, which obviously is not a good way to feel. But I think the trend is going to continue on. So we'll see how it actually goes. I think that maybe on this podcast or elsewhere, I think young people, we need to maybe band together a little bit and talk more about how we could sort of make sure we're not getting the short end of the stick. So any strategies people have had to protect themselves would be, I'd be certainly interested in hearing about. So
the ban starts right now, right here. This is where the revolution starts.
Yeah. Overall, not a good feeling, I would say, because these are some pretty big high profile practices that you would think maybe wouldn't go private equity. And when they do, it sort of says, okay, you know, what am I missing here? And I don't think any of us really love looking at finances and thinking about that, especially finally finishing all this training. You think you made it and you can kind of relax, but this makes me not feel relaxed personally.
Well, and then the last thing I'll ask you, LA Rams 2-0, they've got a point differential of like plus 1,000, but they played pretty bad teams both weeks. They played the Raiders and I believe the Cardinals, and they weren't even going for, their kicker got hurt, so they were going for two on basically every touchdown. They were going for two, which was pretty fun to watch. Ali, yep. You're not a Rams fan, but you live in LA. Are the Rams for real?
The Rams, I think, are for real. I think it's, this might be the Super Bowl year. And, you know, I'm personally coming around a little bit because they have embraced being LA teams. But in LA, if you win, most of the city is going to be behind you. So the Rams are good. I think last year they came on strong and sort of blew it at the end there. But this year, I don't think they're going to make that same mistake. So
Jared Goff, Super Bowl quarterback, really? You have faith?
There's been worse, I would say, but I think that defense, more specifically, and Todd Gurley, who is also on one of my fantasy teams, is more than enough to get him there. So as long as there's no big injury and they keep going, I think they have a very strong chance of making it there.
You know, I know there have been worse quarterbacks that have won the Super Bowl or been there. Like Nick Foles isn't exactly a household name, but he played really well. I'm just a little suspicious of Jared Goff. There's something about Jared Goff. There's going to be a point either in the playoffs or the regular season, he's going to have to actually win them a game. They're going to be in a close game, or they're going to be behind. They won't be able to run Gurley every time, and they won't have that play action if they're way behind. They're going to have to go shotgun, and I'm just concerned that he's, I don't know, we'll find out. He's only in his second or third year, right? He's young, so who knows? Maybe
he's young.
Yeah, maybe he's better than I think he is, but I have the same impression of him as I have Blake Bortles. I'm just like, the ceiling is your quarterback is just not one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the NFL right now. Nick Foles played like one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the NFL last year. And if you look back, Trent Dilfer won a Super Bowl years ago, but in the last like 5, 6, 7, 8 years, everyone who's won a Super Bowl as a quarterback has been legit top 10 quarterback, I think. I mean, Eli Manning notwithstanding, but that would be kind of my impression. I think it's really hard to pick with them in a conference where the other great teams have Aaron Rodgers, Kirk Cousins, I think is better than him. Carson Wentz coming back for the Eagles. I don't know, but we'll see. Hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully the Rams can do it.
Yeah, they play a lot of those teams, so we're going to find out. But I think he might be better than, I mean, his first season, he was so bad that I think people have this kind of impression from him, maybe a little bit of an East Coast bias because he was a West Coast college quarterback. But so far, so good. So we'll see how it goes. But I think the Rams are for real. It wasn't just like a one-year thing. So we'll see where it ultimately ends up, like I said, with injuries and everything. But the city is definitely excited, and people are already placing bets on the Super Bowl. So that might be an LA thing too, but we'll hope for the best. We'll say that.
LA Lakers outlook?
Exciting, but not expecting a whole lot in the way of winning a championship. So I think free agency next year is going to be the time where that clock really starts. And LeBron's media company is only starting to grow even before he steps foot on the court. So I think overall a good move for him personally.
And then finally, top four seed for the Lakers?
No.
No.
I'm gonna go with a no.
So
on
who
a
do
top
you,
four.
Who do you have them ahead of them? Obviously, Golden State, Houston. Who else?
Golden State, Houston. I think San Antonio again might be sneaky in terms of just the record themselves. And I don't know, either Utah coming up or Portland was number three last year, whether to take a step back. But my I think four is optimistic, but more like a five or a six would be more realistic. I'm saying this to also make myself feel better, just in case they do really
lower
bad.
Expectations.
But I don't think any real Laker fans are expecting anything huge until next year's free agency.
Last thing, over under a number of all-stars on the Lakers this year, if I set the line as one.
I'm going to go with an over.
Who's the second one?
I don't know. I think if one of these young guys turns it up, whether it's Kuzma or Ingram, I'm not so sure about Lonzo. If one of those two makes a jump this year, they got a chance. But that's an optimistic over.
Ali, thanks as always for your time. I'll see you at Academy. Hopefully the listeners enjoyed this. It was great,
yep.
Very educational. Shout out to Anthony Obaid, MVP of the podcast today. Two articles that...
Program director or something, definitely take a look at his application. The kid is the kid's for real. So work with him personally, as with UJ. I think he's going to be great.
Okay, Ali, you have a great day, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, see you, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Again, a shameless plug, our first ever online content for ophthalmologist marketing education course will be at the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting in Chicago. Our course will be Monday, October 29th at 4:30 p.m. in room N136. I will be on the panel with Drs. Usiwoma Abugo, Rahul Khurana, Steve Christensen, and Matthew Weed, and we will try to cover it all in that hour. You won't want to miss it. It should be fun and educational. Please come and support us, and if any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 131 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. You'll also find our blog on the website. There's a mailing list you can sign up for that will give you updates on the most recent episodes. There are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Retina Podcast. To contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do, so if you like what we do, give us a thumbs up. If you think there's something we can do better, let us know. And if you have an episode idea, many of our best episodes come from listener episode ideas, so reach out. And we're pretty flexible and creative. If you come up with a good idea, we usually can make it happen. We appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes and Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. M. Ali Khan for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Minicasa, and Angela Chang, who produced this excellent episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.